The brothers Whis.
You're now listening to Greg.
It's the hey, everybody. This is Greg with Brothers Whiffs, number 130. I'm calling in from the motherland, Texas, and it is icy today. Like, literally, there's, like, some icicles stuck to my car.
Like right there?
Yeah. Yeah, that stuff. And you guys just heard one Mike Hammett from Chicagoland.
Should I think something other than say than... something to say other than hey, how's it going? So I guess I'll just say because I didn't think ahead.
Excellent, nicely done, Mike. Way to think outside the bun there. Let's see. So let's get the support stuff out of the way. We don't have any new patrons this week, but aww, if you go to Patreon. You go to patreon.com/thebrothersWhis. You can throw us a couple of bones and get access to our Patreon-only Slack where all the good stuff really happens. That's where the smart guys are, not the dumb guys talking on the podcast. All the smart guys are hiding out in there. But this week, we have some sponsors. We are brought to you by Sonar. It's a scalable, intuitive, and comprehensive ISP and operational support system. Pop over to sonar.software. Give those guys a looky-loo if you would. Oldest and most loyal sponsor. We also have Tower Coverage, towercoverage.com. It's your RF propagation system to empower your network real-time data metrics and enable your coverage area, reaching your customer base, and more. The industry's best RF propagation mapping system allows website integration for customer sign-up and pre-qualification. Use this data to scientifically plan network expansion and help your WISP succeed. Get a free trial today at towercoverage.com. All right, Mikey, you want to whip out the quick bit?
Sure. Quickbit.com, indoor and outdoor 60 gigahertz kit that is just set it and forget it simple. Crazy feature set for the price with API, deployment tools, solid distance, and up to 8 clients per hub.
Excellent.
Just not an online shopping cart.
Not yet. They are super duper close. And their website is kwikbit.com. Quick with a K.
And all a right. W.
Well, yeah, and a W. Yeah, fair enough.
And no U.
Yeah, there's or C. Yeah, never mind. It's, it's there. KWIKBIT.com. Go there, check it out. All right, let's jump into it. I just wanted to start with something light and say that I played my first multiplayer VR game yesterday with one Andrew Cox all the way from Australia, which is still kind of a weird sort of sensation for me to think about, like playing with people across, you know, like your actual friends, you're playing with them. But in VR, I see his character. He's like standing right next to me. We're like moving around and stuff. I don't know. It's just, it was the closest thing to seeing him I've done in a really long time. So it's pretty cool. We were playing Arizona Sunshine. So we're blasting some zombies. And it's actually, I forgot how much fun it is to play games with other people. So I haven't honestly done it in so long.
Yet I used to play excessively online. Like, I mean, high school and shortly after high school, you know, still having jobs and stuff, and I would still put in 40 hours a week playing games. And now it's like I have lived in this house for 4.5 years, and I don't think I've played any games when I've lived in this house at all.
It's weird how that that migration in your brain occurs. You don't even know it. You don't even know it's happening. But I enjoyed it. It was a nice respite, you know, just to kind of mix things up. I had played pickleball earlier in the day, so my knees were like basically gone. So I was kind of like hurting, but it was still, I don't know, man. It was still a blast. Still a blast to do. Hopefully he can break away and do it some more. I know that guy's crazy busy, so. Such is life.
Yeah, it's a, you know, and it's such a shame too, because like I have a new PC. It's crazy good, even though it's just like, and like, why is it so overspec'd for running lots of Chrome tabs and running ArcGIS and like, you know,
mostly the day, Chrome tabs though, right?
Yeah, it's a, well, you know, Chrome has gotten a little better. You know, I haven't seen it creep over 20 gigs. yet on this system. On my old one, it did. But, I mean, it's like, back in the day, it was just like, you know, I need more RAM, I need more CPU, I need more video card, and I still have all those same things, but it's not for the games. It's for all the other tools that I use, and it's like, you know, back in the day, like, I couldn't afford to buy more because, like, and I used it more intently. And, you know, now it's just like, you know, oh, I need this, you know, I don't have time to comb 100 tabs out of Chrome, so let's just buy more RAM so that I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, for sure. I think, to be honest with you, like, probably my average workload, my day-to-day, I could probably run on, like, a Raspberry Pi, and I would be fine, you know, because it's mostly just me, like, RDPing into stuff or SSHing into things or using, like, a browser. I don't commit as many tab crimes as I used to, unlike you, Mike. I'm pretty good about getting things done or documenting what I'm doing so that I can always just come back to it. I'm trying to make it so that I can reboot my machine. Something I have going has got, like, a memory leak because I have to reboot my machine anytime we're going to do one of these casts. I'm going to record with OBS. Otherwise, we get that weird choppy video problem. So I've made it so that it doesn't bother me a lick to just reboot. So I'm feeling it. Other than recording these things, this is probably the most intensive stuff I do, right? Recording, well, then, and then also when you're rendering the video, right? That, you know, that's taking a hit and stuff like that. But I got a gaming laptop a while back because I haven't worked off a desktop in 10 years. And so it's a pretty decent laptop. I think it's like an i7 or an i9. It's older, but it's got 32 gigs of RAM in it, which is pretty good for a laptop that's a few years old. So it does the trick. It gets it done.
Yeah, it's a... I've actually done, not so much with podcasts, but I've been doing a lot of interviews the past couple of weeks. And for the ones that we didn't do on our own in-house, you know, phone system / web meeting platform, I just fired up Camtasia and was like, all right, do a screen record of of this interview so I could, you know, show the rest of the team. Like, okay, you know, what do you think of the personality and blah, blah, blah. As I found out that Indeed, they make you pay more if you want more than one person in on the interview. I'm like, so I'll just record the interview and show it to my guys. So I just, you know, recorded that half of the screen and, you know, process it in Camtasia, dump it up to YouTube, you know, unlisted link. But no, but I mean, so I got 20 or 30 hours of just interview recordings that I've just been churning through on here.
Lord have mercy. So how do you guys rate them? You doing like a 1 to 10 system? Is there a bikini round?
It unfortunately, it's mostly. Can I get anyone that does everything I want them to do? Like, it's not even like a, you know, which of these five guys do I like the best?
Which of these well-qualified applicants am I? Yeah. So you're really just trying to find the applicant that's qualified, right?
Yeah. Like, you know, for our sysadmin job, like, I'm looking, because I'm overloaded. It's not like it's like, oh, hey, you know, I'm comfortable, so let's bring somebody on. No, it's like, I'm overloaded, as I say every time we have a podcast. So trying to hire people where I can just say, here's IPs and passwords and tasks. Go do it. And, like, most of the sysadmin applicants were, like, help desk people. And it's like, you know, some of them showed some promise, some ambition, but it's like, you know, you would make a great junior sysadmin, but I don't need a junior. I need a guy to just hand the keys and make it happen. Except we did have a couple that did hit it out of the park. Some even too far. Like, we've got a guy that does Linux kernel development and stuff. And it's just like, wait, I'm we don't need to build our own Linux. We just need you to run the Linux that we already have. Oh, yeah, it's fine. Okay. But everybody else was just like not nearly good enough.
You'll get there. You'll get there, you know, bud.
You know, trying to handle guys to do some of the outside plant stuff, and we get like landscapers, and it's just like, what? So you can do the restoration when they're done, but I need a guy that knows how to splice. I need a guy that knows, you know, that, you know, just something.
You just have to start teaching people. Call it a day.
Plus, the problem is that it's like when you're overloaded, it's like, do you have time to teach anybody? No.
I don't know. Do you have time not to teach somebody? Is what I'm wondering at this point. Because you're not finding the applicant. Things don't seem to be getting better. It sounds like your only recourse is to bite the bullet and train some guy.
I did find a Linux kernel programmer. So just kind of wait a while and you'll find the guy.
All right. Well, it sounds like you're willing to wait. While you were talking about doing interviews, we did a special interview just the other day, no?
Yes, we did.
We had a little chat with Simon Westlake from sonar.software. And I think it went pretty well. I think maybe I was too soft on him. Should I have roughed him up a bit more?
That's probably the opinion of everybody who was on the cast, including Simon, was that they were expecting a little bit more. And, to be fair, you know, I suppose if we, bit his head off the first go around, he wouldn't come back.
You gotta ease him into it. It also wasn't supposed to be like an AMA where we just ask question, immediate answer, ask question, immediate, you know what I mean? It's like, it wasn't an interrogation. I wanted, to be honest with you, first go around, I just wanted to kind of get a sense of the person behind the software sort of thing. And I guess we got that. And he suggested we do a part two. So I'm absolutely curious about people's questions, that weren't answered on the first one, mind you. If you have some more targeted stuff that you're curious about, I'd be curious to, or rather I would be willing, and it sounds like he's willing to have some more difficult stuff fired at him. And we'll see how good his tap dancing is. Get around all the questions.
I was kind of thinking about that, you know, that probably played out really well as a nice example of how we can have an interview with the vendor and not pile on them.
Yeah.
So that we can perhaps get some more vendors to do similar things.
For sure. Well, I mean, there's more behind interviewing somebody than just asking them questions, right? You have to kind of get a sense of, you know, if you ask them a specific question and, you know, they start becoming defensive, well, if you keep attacking, they keep defending. So you have to change tactics, and then you have to pull back, and then you go back in, and then you pull back and you go back in. Right? You can't just full frontal assault all the time.
Sure. So. And I think, like, despite the fact that not, you know, in our pool of questions that we had, you know, we didn't have probably half of them that we got to, but like the other half, it was like a lot of them were like, well, we didn't ask the question directly, but through the other dialogue that we had that wasn't pertaining to questions, we kind of found our way there by, you know, his explaining how his thought processes are and where he was going with things and his overall intentions kind of answered some of those questions without having to attack him. It's like, okay, well, you know, that answered that.
Yeah, for sure.
And I guess we kind of had something like that a couple of years ago with the EPMP guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Cambium stuff. I remember that. That was a good one.
So other vendors and or fans that would like to see other vendors do something similar to our Sonar one, feed on your vendors to contact us, and we'll arrange something.
For sure, man. All right, you ready to talk to, or rather talk about some hardware stuff? We haven't done that in a minute.
Sure.
All right. So I think it was Nathan. Nathan was talking about how he was He had these Nectonic switches up on a tower, and he thought he like fried it or whatever. So he replaced that, and then lo and behold, that next one, he thought he fried it as well. So he's trying to figure out what was going on. Ultimately, he found out that a lot of the Nectonic switches, if there's no load on them, they sense that as like some kind of air conditioner or whatever. I'm not 100% sure what it is, but they basically just shut off, which I found fascinating because a lot of equipment, at least traditionally, what I do is I'll configure it and then I'll let it burn in, right? I'll just let it sit there and turn away and make sure that no, you know, like capacitor is going to fail, like no obvious component's just going to tip over. So I would have, I probably been pulling my hair out. He said when he had it on the bench, when he was doing that, he had a little radio on there, right, that was pulling a little bit of load, which was enough to keep it alive. And it's not like it was completely dead. It just, you know, just like died for the moment. You had to, I guess, pull power and put power back to it. Is that a new one on you? Like, I hadn't heard of that before.
Yeah, I've never heard of anything doing that. So, like, no load meaning like no PoE load or just like...
Right. Yeah. He just didn't have anything plugged into it. It was just powered up, I guess. Although he must have had something plugged into it because he was trying to administer it and it just fell off the network. So maybe it was just PoE load, no PoE load on any of the ports. Hmm.
I do know that they are a bit finicky with their PoE and like, you know, like if you plug something in when PoE is already on, you can like fry it.
Yeah. But that's the individual port, right?
Right, yeah. You know, not the whole unit, so that's...
That's a new one on me. I hadn't heard of it, but I was thinking it would have bit me and might bite somebody else. I'm not sure. That's wacky wild.
Yeah. So I guess, guys and gals, if you've heard of anything like that before, let us know, because that's new.
For sure. All right, let's talk about some MikroTik stuff, because people love it when we talk way too much about MikroTik. But in particular, they put out 6.49 Beta 11, which had a lot of interesting things. I mean, it's a pretty good list in there. And a lot of them basically said, hey, we're fixing things that we broke in 6.48. Which I introduced in 6.48. So one of them was CRS 3XX series. There was on a bonding interface, you know, like you're doing LACP or just a bond in there. It was doing some kind of weird duplicate packet thing. Also, the PWR-line interface devices, the interface linking got busted. And I think it was Matt Whiteley confirmed that this beta software did actually fix that, as well as they said switch interface toggling, and then had some model numbers. And somebody said that in 6.48, the port flapping on 3011s came back, and I'm assuming that's what they're talking about. So it looks like 6.49 beta 11, they put out a fix for the interface toggling, as they're calling it. But that's unconfirmed whether it is the 30. I mean, is that how you read it, Mike? Is it the 3011 flapping issue, you think?
Sometimes with these change logs, you don't really know. And to be fair, MikroTik's not the only one where you sit there looking at the change log and you don't know what it means. I've seen that with multiple vendors where you're looking at something and it's like miscellaneous fixes and improvements. Joy, what does that mean?
Yeah, sometimes you need a Rosetta Stone to figure out what's going on. Or at least with their naming conventions you do. They've gotten, I've got to say, they've gotten tremendously better about actually putting stuff in change logs. So, yeah.
Sure. I guess if I was thinking ahead, I would have Googled, because MikroTik has a page that tells you which devices have which switch chips. And, so RB3011 series has that QCA8337, which is one of the first ones on that list. So, it does have two of them. So I'm not going to swear to it, but that seems like that would be likely. Looks like the 4011 and the 1100AH have that last chipset. listed, and let's see here, who else has the middle chipset? The regular 1100AH. Interesting. 1100AH, 1100AH, X2. So that's definitely an older product that has been cleaned up with that.
Yeah, that's a guess. I'm assuming somebody from MicroTik will hopefully reach out to us and clear that up for us at some point.
So I guess what we should have done is not spent so much time guessing as to what it is, just boldly say the wrong thing. And then MicroTik will tell us, nope, you're wrong. This is what it actually was. And then we can correct ourselves next time.
For sure. For sure. I mean, so, you know, just a little asterisk and then assume that I don't know. That sounds right. That sounds right. We'll see. We'll go with that.
So they're going with my logic. 6.48.1. It kills puppies. That's what it does. Right?
I think That's people would be less concerned. You should say 6.48.1 causes impotence. I think more people would be concerned about that.
Probably.
Hopefully somebody takes that statement out of context and makes a clip of it. That'd be great. Oh, man. All right. While we're talking about MicroTik, somebody asked around automation, because, you know, I've been paying a lot of attention to automation stuff lately, is how do you do interactive automation? So like in Ansible, because that's what I'm most familiar with, obviously, whenever you're throwing commands, you're using the RouterOS module, and really you're basically just putting out whatever the commands are that you want to issue and then telling the automation to throw those at it. But what happens when you have an interactive prompt? Like you tell it to reboot and it says, you know, are you sure you want to reboot? You can't exactly do that. But what you can do is use the execute command. So in the scripting language, you have the execute command and you can tell it all the commands you want to put in there, separate them by semicolons, and it'll throw it in there in a non-interactive method, which means you don't actually get prompted for, hey, do you want to reboot? Or, hey, are you sure you want to load this firmware? Are you sure you want to, like, it gets rid of the interactive portion and just issues the command, so that fixes all that good stuff. And somebody, I was doing it some other really rigged way. I think I was pushing a script to it, so I was like creating a script on the MicroTik and then running that to get it to around the interactive, and somebody showed me just this specific way. I wish I could give credit to whoever that was, but I just can't for the life of me remember.
But, so then would you do like reboot semicolon Y? Or like how would that look like?
No. Whenever you're telling it to reboot in a non-interactive manner, it never even asks you, hey, are you sure? It just does it.
Oh.
So you say like in the script here, I've got execute / system reboot, and then it's got the semicolon delay for one, and then a semicolon, and then just quit. I'm done. So, hey, reboot. Right. Wait a second. Quit, and it does the upgrade reboot.
Interesting.
Or okay, like system router update. You know, if you just want to throw it at it and tell it to grab it, system router update. Semicolon, delay one, semicolon, quit, I'm done. And it'll grab it and go. So just a little tidbit for you guys out there. All right, let's see. Something else MicroTik related. I've got an apartment complex that I'm managing, and they've got those smart locky things on all the doors. And which is ironic because we just saw, and I think Mike found the FCC posting for it for... So this is going to be a little bit of digression, then I'll come back. But Ubiquiti has UA-Hotel, which are hotel locks for doors, right? So they run in the 13 megahertz band as well as Bluetooth. The idea being now the resident can unlock their door using their phone, right? So it's intelligent. You just run an app on your phone. You walk up, you swipe it by the door, and it's going to unlock. And then like hotels or apartment complexes like I'm doing like that, because apartment complex, you don't pay your bill, your lock doesn't work anymore and you can't get in and out, right? So that's one method. Hotels, that's obvious. They don't have to issue keys to people anymore, right? Now it's just an app that's going to be integrated into, I would assume they would try and integrate it into the hotel's app itself, right? To encourage you to grab their stuff so sure. they can track you a little better.
That's kind of one of those steps towards, and that's one thing that, please don't take this out of context. Well, it's one thing I'm grateful with COVID is that we've started to take a lot more contactless things seriously. Like,
yeah.
So many stores that, you could pay with your phone and stuff, but like before you still had to click on buttons on the machine, pay with card, do this. And now so many of them is just like on your phone, bring up the barcode in front of the barcode scanner, bam, away you go. So like this could be, part of that hotel, contactless hotel check-in.
Yeah.
It just tells you what room number to go to. You just walk to your room. You never see anybody. You never deal with touching keys. You just go straight there. And for tech guys, it's great. No people. Right,
for sure. When you were talking about, in a store, you still have to touch things, and that was weird. I had, so there's a local pizza shop here, not like one of the chains, and we had them deliver pizza. And the guy like knocked, and I was like, all right, pizza's here. And then he knocked again. I was like, what? He didn't drop it and leave. And then, so I had to put my mask on, I opened the door, and he's like, can you sign this? I was like, oh my God. Like I just froze for a second. I was like, he wants me to touch something. This is ridiculous. It was bizarre. I've become the boy in the bubble. It's freaking me out now. So that was so weird, but yeah, I love the idea of the hotel locks. No. Whether you would use the Ubiquiti hotel locks.
I was just going to ask that. Mike. Would you put Ubiquiti locks in?
Cutting you off the pass. I saw somebody in the Slack, and I won't name names, but they said, yeah, just imagine how angry a hotel is going to be when they install 1,000 of these, and then 2 years later, Ubiquiti decides they're not going to support them anymore. Like, yeah, I mean, that's a risk you take. I'm assuming... It's probably, so I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to make some speculative guesses here. It's going to have a controller based. I can't imagine they would throw that into Unify. It's like, why would you put, I'm saying that they're probably going to do it. But if in a perfect world, if they were doing this right, they would put it into a system that's got a very comprehensive API where they could, basically never use the GUI if they didn't want to, right? You could add locks, remove locks, add users, disable their access, do all that stuff via an API. So if you've got an existing hotel system, right, it's going to be able to easily integrate in there. Even if you have to use some glue to piece it together, like using Ansible or something like that, if it doesn't have native API support for this right thing, you could make it kind of fake its way in there. But if they don't do it like that, they're doing it wrong. And I can't imagine somebody would do mass adoption of it if it doesn't have a good automated interface for their existing tool sets. But I digress. Let me go back to the original thing. They've got, and I'm not sure what brand it is. I mean, I could look it up, but I don't remember right off the top of my head. They have these locks. And of course, all the locks are battery powered. And then on each floor, I've got two IDFs. And in each IDF, they place what they call a hub. Sometimes they have more than one. And these hubs are basically just the access point / base stations that those door locks connect into. The hubs are actually, I'm PoE powering those jokers off of my switches. And so occasionally these things are a little buggy and they'll lock up. So like people on an entire side of a floor won't be able to use their door locks all of a sudden. So they'll have to go in there and reboot. And I really don't want them touching my cabling anymore. So the idea being they basically inventoried which hub is on which port of all of my switches. So I'm just going to write a little web app that's going to have a bunch of buttons, like one for each one of the hubs, right? That correspond to whatever it is. And if they log in, they get to the web page, they click the button. I'm just going to have it call an Ansible script that connects to my switch, power cycles that port, just tells it, hey, go down for 5 seconds, come back. I think it's I think there's a default command in there that's, I know it's at least in there from Winbox. If not, it would be super easy to script, right? You would just tell it delay 5 seconds, you know, turn off, delay 5 seconds, turn back on. Bob's your uncle, you're going to be done. And I think also, like, something like this thing's got like a controller at the top end, and if that thing loses power, you have to like reboot everything in a specific sequence. I don't know, man. It's like hot garbage as far as I'm concerned.
That's what it sounds like.
Yeah. So I think I'll probably have another button that basically says reboot these things in the proper sequence, and you can click it and it'll just ripple down and do all of those. But if you know, I was thinking about, you know, how do I do all this stuff, and it's coming up with these complex ways. I was like, why am I overcomplicating this? Just have a simple web page, you know, with a login that's protected. Because this guy, you know, like the apartment manager, he wants to be able to do it even if he's not on site. Like if he's at home in the middle of the night, you know, obviously door locks is something you would want to take care of. And in lieu of having to drive up there and jack these things in the middle of the night, he would just be able to pop in and boop it. So, yeah, I'm just thinking like simple web page. Username and password protected, or you know, like what is it, like an HT access file or something that makes it like pop up a little dialog box and you put in a username and password. Something just super ugly and simple, and then just a page of buttons I think would probably do the trick.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's no need to go with some fancy, you know, bootstrap responsive template. Just HTML, hit, title. Head, body, bang, just stupid simple.
Just so long as it looks okay on a cell phone, that's all that matters. Boop.
Sure. It's and I think I think HT access is actually still like one of the most secure. I'm potentially speaking out of my backside here, but I think that the .HT access files are still like one of the most secure ways of actually securing the site. In term, you know, it's much harder to break than if you were to develop some sort of actual interactive login system.
Yeah. I mean, there's no SQL injections. It's so plain and simple. There's almost nothing you could do to it that would break it. And then I guess you could theoretically, somebody could try and brute force their way in there, but you could just have something basic, you know. What's the thing that watches your web server? I used to run it and then put like the OWASP rule set on there. I can't remember off the top of my head, but it's basically just software that watches it.
Fail to ban?
Is it ModSec? Is that it?
Oh, I think we're talking about different things then. I'm not sure.
Open source web application firewall, ModSec. Yeah, so you just run ModSec and you tell it the OWASP rule set, and it'll just like watch everything. And like, if there's too many failed logins and stuff like that, or if people are trying to compromise it, it'll just add a firewall rule that like block them.
This is a good tangent. So I've mentioned fail to ban. I've got that rigged up on a couple of my servers, and it watches a whole variety of log files. One of them does web hosting. I only have a few domains on it, but it watches FTP logins, SSH logins, and all this stuff, because they're not things I can lock down, because there's external people that have to log in. So then it watches all these log files, including HTTP log files. It looks for, you know, people attempt, you know, like 404s on known, like, you know, WP admin logins and stuff like that. It looks for known bad 404s and, you know, counts those as intrusion attempts. Anyway, so then it adds them to IP tables for like a month or two. It also then looks up their IP blocks abuse contact. It then emails them after they've had three or four attempts. I forget how many. It then emails them a copy of the logs showing, hey, somebody at this IP at this date and time did all these things. And it's gotten a lot better now. Like when I started doing it, I was getting hundreds per day of emails of confirmations of, you know, things getting blocked, and then ticket responses from tickets created from me emailing them a copy of the log file. And a lot of the companies, well, some of the companies don't really do much, but it is satisfying that when I go look at that folder in that inbox, seeing various companies responding saying, you know, customer has been disabled, the customer has been blah, 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 customer cleaned up their problems, so on. So that's satisfying to know that, like, in some small way, I've made the internet a little better.
I still remember getting emails like that for our customers, and we would basically take that and pass it on to the customer, and yeah, they would get their stuff fixed. There was one in particular, you know, when you're running a data center, you got a lot of interesting characters there, and they were like this small hosting-ish provider / MSP. Man, they were getting popped all the time. They were always doing some boneheaded stuff. It was ridiculous.
And so now, it kind of is a good segue into my next segue of, so when you would send that into or off to your customers, would you sanitize who sent it or just forward as is?
As per our policy, no customer actually existed at my data center, right? So if you called in and said, hey, I'm from so-and-so, if you weren't on the list, I didn't know you, and I didn't know if that customer actually existed in there, right? So I wouldn't confirm with those people anything.
Sure.
Yeah, I would just verify that it was one of our customers, and then I would make sure that it was, you know, like it didn't have any, like, malware links or anything like that, you know? And then I would forward that over to them. And then, you know, if I got no response, then I would give them a little call just to make sure that they got it.
So then would your customer then know who sent the complaint?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would see who it was.
Okay. Because I have a feeling that someone did that. One of the people I complained to, I complained to, I wasn't involved other than setting it up 2 years ago, 3 years ago, whatever it was. Because if last week, at about 4 a.m., I have an email from my hosting provider saying that we have noticed unusual traffic to your server and we have shut it off for the next hour. Well, not shut it off, but, you know, BGB black holed it for the next hour. I thought, I didn't see this in the morning, obviously. I'm not awake watching generic emails. So I'm going back through my emails for the night. Okay, that's interesting. Is it back up now? Yeah, it's fine. Okay, great. Just going back through my emails. Also during the middle of the night, but a little bit before that, I have an email from somebody that I assume is either a compromised account or some sort of anonymous email service. With some expletives in there and a you reported my friend's VPS server, now get DDoSed. And there's a screenshot showing, you know, ping space, you know, my company's website name, which isn't on my network. It's on a web hosting network. It all says timed out and a web browser showing they tried to get to my site and it didn't work. And it's, then there's more expletives and so on. So it's like, so they only found out who it was because their web host didn't sanitize who complained. And so then they knew, oh, this guy complained. Or, well, this this domain complained. And so let's figure out who they are and DDoS them.
Right. Well, my thinking was, my logic was, say it was like a banking website or something like that, that the customer would ultimately want to get to, but they, you know, they were blacklisted their IPs or whatever. So if they wanted to rectify that, I wanted them to know, you know, who to get a hold of or whatever, or
sure,
if they needed additional information. It's kind of like, hey, Bob, meet Sally. Sally, meet Bob. And then I, you know, wipe my hands and back away sort of thing. I never want to get in the middle of that stuff.
Sure.
If I can get out of doing some extra work, I will, for sure.
It Now, I will admit that I did nothing other than just ask for more information from my web host. I didn't stop what I was doing because you DDoS me my website at 4 a.m. and it goes down for a little bit. I care. And they haven't done anything else. You know, they haven't DDoSed it again. They haven't DDoSed my ISP, you know, IP space. So I'm like, all right, well, unless something else happens. Well, I'm sure it'll happen again because I'm sure they just got a new VPS at the same place, and the same place is going to forward over my next complaint that I have. So I'm sure it'll happen again, but it's just like, you know, if that's all I'm going to suffer, then I'm going to keep doing it because I don't care.
if it smacks the web hosting company's network, it's not a bother of yours.
Oh, and it's at 4 a.m. Like what's happening at 4 a.m.?
Yeah. Nothing. Yeah. Nobody's hitting your side at 4 a.m. Yeah, for sure.
Now I do need to spend a little bit more time and see, you know, kind of firm up the, all the Cloudflare stuff, you know, because I have Cloudflare, but apparently it's only on, you know, www dot, not, you know, my root domain. And so then one goes to the server, one goes to Cloudflare. So, you know, I need to clean that up a little bit because then they DDoS Cloudflare and
yeah,
they care even less.
Yeah.
And so fine, go ahead.
For sure. I think it was, you know, switching topics very violently. Wasn't it you that found out that Speedtest now has a video test service, right?
Yes, and I have to see from the server side, like, if that's just included for everybody or what, you know, or if only, you know, you have to opt in or if it's, or you have to create a new server. But from what I understand, it's you know, they've kind of picked up on the fact that some places are just DSCP prioritizing speed test sites, so then you always get your full speed every time, doesn't matter what. And I suspect they knew that a long time ago, just didn't really know what to do to get around that. And apparently what they do now is they just do some test video streams. I don't know if you actually see it or not because I don't have an iPhone. The client is only on iOS at the moment. But they do some video tests and they tell you, well, you know, you would get 4K or you would get 1080p or you would get whatever. To kind of work around that. And I'm sure they'll just figure out some other way of swatting the tests. And there'll be a cycle, but, you know, it's kind of nice to see that, you know, as someone who doesn't cheat like that. Great. Go ahead.
Yeah, for sure. I think it's pretty cool, and it's just another tool in the toolbox, so long as the service works well, which I hope it does. So if it doesn't, if it doesn't work well, then, you know, it's just going to be bad for everybody involved. But I guess you'll be able, because I know some people throttle some streaming video, you know, like Netflix and stuff like that. But this technically probably won't get hit with that matcher, right? Because it's not going to be coming from Netflix. So it should show that everything's... So I don't know how true a test it'll be. Because if somebody's manipulating traffic, they're probably doing it to specific services anyway.
Yeah, it's... Well, like, I know that, like, some of the DPI services can kind of lump stuff together. You know, you just choose, you know, rate limit video streaming to this, which is actually, even when net neutrality was a thing, that would have still been allowed as long as you were transparent. You could throttle video services as long as you did so equally. Or, you know.
Yeah.
Well, I guess non-discriminatory. Torally, not necessarily.
Yeah, you didn't just pick one to get mad at or whatever.
Yeah, so which really makes sense from an operator standpoint. If you don't, you know, if if you don't have some personal vendetta against any particular service, you're just having capacity issues.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, you just limit all of them.
Well, I mean, I think COVID was a good introduction for a lot of people on that, as like most of Europe, like magic, you know, just like all of a sudden started throttling Netflix speeds and things like that, you know, because they were basically just overloading the networks. They couldn't handle it with everybody locked in their house. That's all they were doing. So, you know, they did it countrywide.
Oh yeah. I find it funny how, like, you know, you always hear about, you know, how bad U.S. broadband is. And it's like, oh, you know, we've got, you know, pick some random European or Asian country, you know, oh, we've got, you know, 600 megabits for, you know, $15. And you're like, there's no way that's really going to work. And, yeah, COVID hits, everybody starts using their connections, and oh wait, it doesn't actually work. The US, you know, there were challenges, but it wasn't, you know, I mean, I don't know anybody that was like, darn, my internet really sucks now. It wasn't, because our networks were already better. That's why they cost more.
Yeah. You know, I was just thinking about it. I'm willing to bet our southern states probably fared better than your northern ones, because I think we locked down less. You know,
sure.
I think we were a little bit more liberal with that stuff. So I think people being able to actually leave their house and go out and do stuff probably impacted how much data usage hit down.
Sure.
There.
Sure. I was trying to figure out on the server side, and they don't really mention anything. So I don't know. I guess I should just get my wife's iPhone and try it and see what happens.
Yeah, I've got Android too, so. I think somebody tried it. They just, I mean, I don't know. Details are going to be limited on what's actually going on right now. I guess, is it full meal deal, ready to go for all iOS, or is it still kind of a beta thing? It doesn't really say on the site, does it?
No, it's just kind of more talking, you know, I guess it's probably more consumer focused than tech focused, so.
Yeah. Oh, well, just one more tool in the toolbox. That'll be cool. All right. We'll see what's next. Somebody was asking about leaky feeder cable in the Slack. I think they were trying to bring Wi-Fi to an interesting place. So if you guys aren't familiar with leaky feeder cable, it's basically an antenna. It really looks like a piece of what? Like RG6 coax, only it generally has kind of a more rigid, instead of like... you know, a lot of that RG6 coax will have like wire mesh around the outside of, you know, so you've got the jacket on the outside and just inside that, you've got the wire mesh in there. Excuse me. So instead of wire mesh, you generally have more of a corrugated metal in there. So the corrugations give it a little bit of flexibility. It's obviously not going to be as flexible as kind of a mesh that would be in there normally. But inside, or rather, in that metal jacket, that corrugated metal jacket, you have these little squares or rectangles cut out, and they call those windows. And the window size corresponds to the frequency that you want to leak out and into the cable. So they have window size for, say, 5 gigahertz, and I think, you know, you're like your 2.4, your regular Wi-Fi stuff. But then these things are used in a lot of varying applications. So I think, I want to say they were pioneered for use in, like, mine shafts. Right, where they have, especially nowadays, they have a lot of equipment that's going to go a long way down into the earth, and those things have a lot of sensors, there's a lot of telemetry associated with that, and I think they even do some self driving stuff in there too, right? They have a lot of surveillance in there. There's just a lot of data acquisition they have to do, so they needed an antenna that could span long distances, so they made these leaky feeder cables, right? Piece of coax, little rectangles cut inside of that that cladding, or whatever you call it, inside of there. So you put a regular antenna connector on that, you screw that thing in, and Bob's your uncle. The only downside is, if your, say your leaky feeder cable is 10 feet, it's going to have a pretty good output on signal, right? If it's 100 feet, that signal output is going to drop, right? Just because you're having to carry all that stuff over a longer wire, which is ultimately a longer cable. And it also has some other weird eccentricities that I ran into. So whenever I was doing the Grizzlies thing, doing the Wi-Fi. That was one of the things I experimented with. I was trying to give the best customer signal experience, all that stuff. And so one of the things that I investigated was leaky feeder cable. Could I put these things underneath people's seats? So it's not the first time this has been done, because most airplanes, that's how they do their Wi-Fi inside. They actually use leaky feeder cable that just runs up and down the fuselage. Right. And if you think about it, that's actually a pretty good idea, because you're going to get pretty symmetrical service all the way down this metal tube going through the sky. You don't have to worry about, you know, antennas and stuff like that, you know, because think about it. What attenuates signal better than just about anything else is water and meat. And you got a whole bunch of it packed into the plane. Right? So the leaky feeder cable can give really good service, kind of radiating outwards from it to passengers. So why not in a stadium? So I was doing some testing there. So one thing I found is that I got some sample stuff from some folks that do airplane cables. I believe it was airplane cables. I can't remember who it was. It was a well-known manufacturer. It might've been like 3M or something like that. And that stuff was crazy expensive. So what I started doing was shopping around on Alibaba. And you can get it very reasonably priced from China, exceptionally reasonably priced. So if you really want to test it, you could probably buy a little sample piece from somebody here, right? So you can get it quicker instead of having to wait for it come all the way over from China. You know, try it out. If you find that it actually works for your application, then go AliExpress or Alibaba, get that stuff in bulk. But what I learned about using it is, when I was first testing it, I just dropped it straight on the concrete. So the stadium I was in, which was the FedEx Forum, I mean, it's the whole thing is just concrete. It's concrete everywhere. The basketball floor is actually in big squares. They're like 4x4 squares that they break down and put up. Those guys are pretty bananas, actually. The operations guys that pick those floors up and put them down. Some I've seen them before where they've got... the University of Memphis plays inside the FedEx Forum. So in the morning, they would have the university's floor down. And then there was a Grizzlies game that night. So after the Memphis game, as soon as everybody got cleared out of there, the crew would come in, they would tear that floor out, then they'd put the Grizzly floor in. Then the Grizzlies would play. And then the next day, they would have a concert. So that night, as soon as they cleared everybody out, they'd rip that floor up. The riggers would come in. They would start getting set up for that concert. And then by the time that concert hit, you know, they would have just finished a few hours before. Concert would hit, and then they would have to pick back up, break all that crap back down, and then put the floor back together for, like, another game. It was just crazy. I'm going way down a rabbit hole. I actually need to do a podcast where I just talk about all those experiences, because that would be maybe interesting to somebody. I need to get out of my head before I forget it all. But leaky feeder cable, I set it straight on the concrete, and I was trying to do some testing, and it was just awful. The signal was just attenuating like crazy. I couldn't figure out what was going on. I did some research. Well, I found out you don't want to place it directly on the ground, because that's exactly what it does. It just eats the signal. There's something about being close to the earth that just noms it. So I got some chairs and I spaced them out every so often. I just ran the cable along the top of the chairs, and all of a sudden the signal was actually pretty damn good. So I was like experimenting on how high and how low I could get it off the ground. So I found if you get that leaky feeder cable a foot off the ground, that's kind of the maximum signal, right? I mean, obviously if you go higher, the signal's great, but the closest you could get to the ground and retain maximum signal was about a foot. You could go lower, right? But it's going to get a little bit less. So depending on your environment, that might be okay, that might not. Something else I learned is that if you have, say, conduit, like you've got some metal of some sort, it could be like red iron, right? It could be a beam or something like that. If you're strapping it straight to that stuff, guess what it does to the signal? Completely murders it, right? So that attenuates the hell out of it too. I'm assuming because the big structure is grounded or something like that. I'm not 100% sure why, but I just know that it does do that. So you have to kind of give it a little gap. So what I was testing was, how do we put it under the seats, right? And so what I did is I actually snaked it under some of the seats and did some testing there. Of course, you got to wait till there's meat in the seats before you can really see what the signal looks like. And I did one test one day like that. and it actually worked exceedingly well. Doing the leaky feeder cable, and I think I was using, what was I using? I was using the Unify outdoor access points, so, you know, with the external connectors, and just screwed them in there. It worked exceedingly well. The only problem was the design of the seats and of the precast, you know, the concrete that was already there. I couldn't get proper distance from everything. The only way I could mount that stuff, right, and have enough separation from everything would mean I would have to like have some kind of custom bracketry and stuff like that. And it was just the way they were designed, I would never be able to get like maximum, like proper signal. And also because they would be sticking out. And a rule they have in arenas is if people can touch it, it's going to get ripped off. So like anything you mount has to be out of reach, absolutely out of reach. So that stuff was definitely not out of reach under there. And it would just came down to the design of the stadium when they built all that stuff. So it's not to say that I think leaky feeder cable would be really awesome, because if you put it under the seats, like I did some testing where if you're just sitting there and you're holding your phone, you get amazing signal, but it attenuates really fast because it's being generated from like under your legs. And so as that signal moves, it's moving through humans and it gets attenuated really fast, which also helps shield it from other radios in the vicinity. And that's one of the problems you have in like a closed arena, is that it's, you got a big salad dish on top of all this concrete. So everything just wants to bounce around. So it's a nightmare. So that was actually a really good solution. In that instance, I think I had always kind of dreamed in my head, if you had like a hotel, could you just run leaky feeder cable down the center corridor and have it actually work pretty well? I bet you could. I bet that would actually work with like the speeds required at a hotel and the somewhat infrequent utilization of it. I think that would actually be a really good option. So you could have fewer APs, fewer like touch points of presence in there. You know, you don't have stuff that could theoretically get broken, because these cables are tough. And if it did get busted, you could probably just throw a new one up there or just splice it and not have a problem with it. So nobody ever said, hey, come test in this hotel, but I'm willing to bet that would actually work pretty well. So somebody had asked what I know about leaky feeder cable. That's what I know about leaky feeder cable. So there you go. I actually talked way too much about that, I think.
I'm sure people loved it. I mean, I was watching it. I wasn't doing something other work.
I was enthralled. Yeah, man, that was a journey that I went on over there at the Grizzlies. That was one of the most stressful points in my life. So, one of the guys. So when I got hired in there, I met this big, like this big bear of a man, and he was like the guy that was running the IT there. He's a guy named Will Lewis. And he talks like this. He's real deep and slow. And whenever I talk to him now, he goes, hey, G, what's good, man? I love that dude. He is like the best. And I want to sit down on a podcast with him and just talk about, you know, that time, the build, all the stuff that went into it. I think that would be, that'd be really interesting. I'd like to, I don't know, man. I just love talking to that guy. I think it would be really fun to get all that stuff out. And because he's going to remember. So, well, I mean, I was mostly on my own with a lot of that stuff, but he'll remember bits and pieces here and there. I think it would be fun. So if anybody's interested, let me know and I'll apply some pressure on him. I've already kind of nagged him about it, but he keeps finding ways of wiggling out of it. All right, Mikey, tell me about some of the stuff you got on the list here, bud.
Sure. So I added the AirFiber 60 HD. That was recently FCC certified. And about as quickly as it was certified, Ubiquiti retracted it.
What does that mean?
I didn't actually read the document. I just saw people commenting on Facebook. They apparently put something in saying, you know what, we actually don't intend on marketing this. Dismissal request letter.
Oh, weird.
They said, oops. To whom it may concern, we, Ubiquiti Inc., hereby declare that no product bearing FCC ID SWX AF60HD has been marketed or sold in the United States as well as anywhere in the world. Due to the marketing date being undecided, we would like to request a voluntary dismissal of this application ASAP for confidentiality reasons.
For confidentiality reasons. Weird. I was thinking, why even bother? Does it like cost you a lot of money and like you have to maintain that thing or something if they're not planning on using it yet? Or
well, it happened the day after they got the grant, so it almost seems like somebody submitted something for certification that they weren't supposed to.
Hmm. As I say, the cat's out of the bag because you have to pretty much submit everything, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like, well, it's there, so you might as well. I didn't look through it too much myself, but I did hear that it may have actually included an SFP.
Happy days.
So it almost would seem like then that, I don't know, maybe they sent it in. Yeah, here we go. Looking at a diagram, and it does show an SFP port. This would be the first Ubiquiti power product that would have one. Just with my tinfoil hat on, I then wonder if Robert found out that Mike might finally get his Ubiquiti product with an SFP port and yanked it.
Gotcha. So this was all an elaborate prank on you.
Could be.
Yeah. Well, I from my interactions with him, he does seem like the kind of guy that would go all in. If he decided to prank you, it sounds like he would definitely go all in to accomplish that task.
All right, well.
I'd feel flattered if I was you.
Yeah.
So what's the Ubiquiti Talk Conference? What's that thing?
So a while ago, Ubiquiti had some Android-based phones, desk phones. And it seemed like it lasted less time than MFi did. A lot of people said the phones weren't really usable. It was just like it was a tablet, which is great for software functionality reasons, but as a phone, it wasn't really that good. You know, people are expecting a phone, not a tablet. And there were just a bunch of things that people weren't happy with in general with the product, and it got shelved pretty quickly. And so I thought it was odd that in my FCC ID alerts, I saw actually this one and then one of the other phones that they've come out with somewhat more recently had an update. But apparently they're relaunching the line. As I was posting about it, people were, you don't know about this? I'm like, well, I know they had it before, and they gave up, and sorry for not being able to keep up with Ubiquiti's ADD. And somebody said, point taken.
I remember the first version of those phones, I was curious when I was going to install them when I was working at the Grizzlies. I was thinking about, because they had a Cisco phone system there. They were using Call Manager, and I was thinking, man, I'm going to have to replace all these phones. This would be a big old pain in the butt. But it never materialized. And I think, wasn't it like that early version of Ubiquiti phone, wasn't it like you couldn't just add it to a regular SIP server or something like that? Or maybe you could, there just wasn't like a good support for that handset, with all the different providers.
Yeah, I don't remember the details too much because I was happy with the phones I was already using at the price point I was using them at and the systems I was using them on. And so the drawbacks or the generally poor feedback I was hearing did not entice me to look any stronger at it. But apparently they're trying again. Apparently now they have some sort of integration with Unify Protect so that if you have them like on your screen, it will show you what's on, or somehow it can show you what's on some of your cameras. just right on your phone.
That could be cool.
Which is a cool integration, but it's like, it's kind of like on the same line as your, you know, as the hotel door locks. That's a pretty big commitment to something that could just disappear. You know, not just the phone system, you know, the phones, but apparently they will also provide phone service as well. So it's like, so you're going to tie your phone service to Ubiquiti?
I guess that would be, they'd be all right for like a small office or something, no? I mean, I'm assuming that's what they're targeting, right? Not like a big enterprise call center.
I mean, I would assume so, but it's like, you know, like you were saying that, you know, the comments about the, you know, hotel door lock stuff, it's like, the stuff could just disappear at any time. And your phones, kind of important. Just like, you know, for the people that are using the, you know, UISP billing, I think it used to be called UCRM, you're going to have Ubiquiti do your billing and your credit card processing and your phone service and your door locks. That's going to have to marinate for a while.
I like your Tina Belcher groan there. That's pretty good. But, yeah, I don't know. I think if they make a phone that you know, is as good as like a Yealink or a Grandstream and can connect to any provider, then I don't know. That's fine with me. Just so long as it's not like locked to their software and you can't just easily add different services and phones, then that would stink. You know, as long as it's more, a little bit more generic and usable, I think that would be good.
Well, and that's kind of the thing. But like, as you've seen with like Unify Protect, they had a system that was somewhat more open, and then they closed it down. So whatever is open, how long will it be open?
We'll see. I'll stay optimistic. Oh, instead of pessimistic, I'll be good on that. So, what's this, we're at about the hour. Well, we're actually at about an hour and 10 minutes. So let's pick one more of your remaining things. Let's talk about that and then we'll kill it. What do you think?
Sure.
All right, man. What do you like on there?
Starlink at Ripe Atlas. Ripe Atlas, for those that don't know, Ripe is the European organization in charge of internet addressing and internet numbers. They are the Europe equivalent of North America's ERIN or LACNIC in Central South America. Or, oh crap, what's the...
The Asia one?
Asian one. I just forgot the Asian one. AFRINIC is for Africa. APNIC, something like that.
Asia Pacific.
Yeah. That sounds right. Anyway, now that we're somewhat global, I figured I probably had to, you know, okay, I don't know who Ripe is. Okay, I don't know who ERIN is.
Yeah.
So they, so Ripe is actually one of the, they're probably at the top of the RIRs that do a lot of their own development work, build a lot of their own programs. Not that others don't do their own development, but it's like they're always doing something. And this Ripe Atlas project is, they've got probes, tens of thousands of probes all over the world. Mm-hmm. And you can just go to their website and request one, and they'll just mail you one. Your ASN and this and that, but then they'll just mail you one. And it's just by running one, you get credits built up. That then you can then run your own tests. So you can do, you know, you can pick 500 probes that are in the Middle East and have them do a DNS lookup, and then you can compare all the differences. And so it's just, you know, or trace routes or pings or a whole variety of tests. So it's really great for measuring all kinds of things on the internet. Someone up in Vancouver area has a Starlink setup. That's the Elon Musk satellite internet deal. And they have put a RIPE Atlas probe on it. Hmm. And so you can go to the RIPE website, and, you know, he included a link to his, you know, his specific unit, so you can test from his unit, and you can do tests. You can do a trace route from the, you know, going over Starlink from wherever it is that he has installed that to whatever you want. Hmm. Trace routes, pings, so on. So that's kind of a cool from a usability standpoint, but from an odd standpoint, the ASN that the IP address comes from is Google Wi-Fi.
It's weird.
Like it's a client of the main Google ASN 15169, but it's Google. So it's like Starlink is using Google Wi-Fi. What? What's going on?
I don't know. That's curious. That could mean, I mean, that could mean a lot of different things. They could just be partnering with them up there to, like, I don't know, just to get off the ground in that area. And then as demand requires, or maybe they're building right now, right? Google's always trying to do that that thing where they're trying to expand internet borders or whatever. So maybe there's some kind of deal. Maybe they have some kind of deal with the government up there where they're, you know, like helping get broadband out to the remote access areas or something like that. Who knows? I don't know. There might be some publicity on it somewhere, because usually those guys, you know, want to get pats on the back for that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's, I guess Google did kill their Project Loon, which was the big weather balloon type things. So maybe this is their path towards, you know, how to solve, you know, bring broadband to the middle of nowhere is just by being the ground network for Musk.
Hmm. I'm sure he's absolutely open to anybody helping him. It makes sense. It's a big task ahead of him. I've got a cousin that lives in Axel, Texas, which is like a little nothing town. And I got him to sign up, and he sent me the screenshot of his sign up today, and they said they're going to be moving into that area mid to late 2021. So I should mid to late 2021 get to play with one. I'm assuming I'll go, and I doubt he'll need me to help him set it up, but I'm going to go help him set it up and play with it in the process. I think it'll be cool.
What's real interesting about that is that, like, so WISPs seem to be somewhat divided, you know, and obviously, like most things, the, you know, biggest group is people that just don't care. But of those that do, it's like half of them are like, this is the end of the world. And then the other half are like, no, I mean, it's going to be like, or it's a complete farce. There's nothing true about it. It's going to be garbage. It's not going to last. Like, the you know, two extremes. And what was the most, you know, because they just, you know, because lots of people compare it to existing satellite. It's like, well, you know, HughesNet or Viasat sucks, so this is going to suck too. It's like, well, no, there's already demonstrated that people with latencies less than 30 milliseconds.
Yeah, this is a different animal, right? These are LEO satellites, right?
Yeah, and. Like, well, you know, capacity, blah, 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 you know, of course it's fast now. Well, yeah, but there's also only a fraction of the satellites in the air. Mm-hmm. I mean, his first phase has 12,000 satellites. He's got, I think, like 8,000 up there now. So he's got 10 times the number of satellites in the first phase. And then the second phase adds another 30,000 satellites.
That's like when you have one access point oversubscribed, what do? You shrink the cell size, you put more APs up, and then all of a sudden my capacity goes up. Same thing. I mean, it's the same. It's common sense, right?
It, and then, like, somebody shared a video from Calix, the, you know, DSL and, you know, fiber, you know, access equipment provider. And their CEO was on talking. Oh, you know, well, you know, there was lots of like non-specific information that he was talking about, but then he was talking about, you know, over the United States with 12,000 satellites and then just computing land area percentages. But over continental United States, or, you know, over the United States itself, it's only going to be like 2% of the total surface area of the planet. So of the 12,000 satellites, that's how many satellites are over the U.S. at any given point in time. And then there's about, then they have about 20 gigs per second capacity per bird. So it's like, so then that's only 4,800 gigs per second. And yeah, to somebody selling, you know, 10 GPON, 4,800 gigs really isn't a lot. I mean, that's 480 ports on your platform. It's nothing. At the same time, compare it to existing satellite platforms. The, I forget if it was Hughes or Viasat. Well, I mean, I looked up both, but there's more information available on one of them. Like their two newest satellites that they have, like one's 280 gigs per second, the other is around 200. So they have around 500 gigs per second right now. And Musk is planning on 4,800 gigs per second over just the United States, not to mention everywhere else. Like, yeah, all of a sudden, yeah, that is real bandwidth. That's a 10 times increase over what we have now. That's a huge deal.
Yeah, and anybody who's ever messed with satellite, traditional satellite, like your HughesNet stuff, it's the latency that kills you. It's not the bandwidth. It's just how sluggish everything is. Because I remember I was trying to work remote. Oh, man, this was like 15 years ago. And like RDP sessions were a nightmare. You would click, and then you'd wait. And you'd click, and then you'd wait. And it was just, I mean, it was almost unusable. But with latency, you know, what are they talking about? 30 to 50 milliseconds, right? On average? That is killer. Man, it's a game changer.
Yeah, but, you know, at the same time, like, I look at it as, like, to your, you know, it will help people that are outside of WISP coverage area where it doesn't make sense to even build a WISP. You know, those Montanas and Nebraskas and Kansases and, you know, where there's just dozens and dozens of miles of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Now you'll be able to get good internet. You know, at the same time, people are like, well, you know, it's going to be everywhere. You know, Comcast and AT&T are going to be. No, they're not. Like, that's not going to have. That's not going to hurt them. You know, there's just not enough. You know, as I was saying, you know, 4,800 gigs is a lot of capacity compared to a satellite now. That wouldn't be anywhere near enough to do suburban Chicago.
Yeah,
like not we even get close.
We get, I'm doing air quotes here. We get gig speed to our house on our cable modems, but at, you know, peak time, I mean, you're looking at, you know, 300 to 500. So, you know, I mean, it's pretty crazy, like the density of users and stuff here. So that, like, even like at peak time, if I'm getting 300 megabits versus the what theoretical, like 130 that people are seeing or whatever on that stuff. You know what I mean? I guess you would feel that. I wouldn't. Man, I'm such a light user. Like, I'm such a lightweight. I wouldn't feel the squeeze. But some people, you know, that are just looking at numbers and comparing that crap, you know, they would feel the squeeze. So that would make a difference to them.
Sure. And so, yeah, so once all 42,000 birds are in the air, and the U.S. would have, assuming no advances in capacity, the U.S. would have about 16.8 terabits per second of Musk capacity, which is huge for a satellite now, but compared to terrestrial, no. I mean, I would bet all the WISPs in the U.S. already have more than 16.8 terabits of capacity, not to mention wireline operators. I mean, 16.8 terabits really isn't a lot. I mean, it is for any one of us small operators, but in the scope of the United States, 16.8 terabits is nothing.
Yeah, it's a drop in the bucket. Well, it's interesting. I'm still curious to see how this stuff shakes out and what the timelines and all this stuff are. I just want to get in there and play with it a little bit, see what do. I'm not super worried about it for like the MDU market, stuff like that. I don't think it's going to take over in any significant way. So hopefully I'll get to keep playing that game for a while and expanding in that area. I have fun playing with that stuff.
If you're able to build anything wireline, you're not going to have to worry about it. You know, if you're building your Wisp well now, I mean, you know, obviously if you're in a treed area, you're really limited, but then so is satellite. You know, you're not going to be able to see the satellites that well either if you're covered in trees. So it'll be interesting to see there. But, you know, yeah, some Wisps are going to drop off because they're just not that good. But I think a lot of people will still be around because it's going to take some time to get all that going. And, you know, there's the, you know, usually it's, you know, customer service is what fails as you scale a company. And that's a company that has to scale. There is no small plans when you're doing 42,000 satellites.
Yeah, that's insane.
And so, you know, how do small operators compete against big ones everywhere? Customer service.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Mike. Well, I think that's a good place to stop it. We only made it to 1 hour and 20, so we're doing a short one today, apparently. So long-winded, the both of us. Mikey, if folks want to get a hold of you out on the internet, how would you have them do that, bud?
Patreon.com/TheBrothersWisp.
All right, baller. If you want to get a hold of me, you can go to Greg@GregSoul, or rather, you can email me at Greg@GregSoul.com, or you just visit my website, GregSoul.com, where I'm pretty regularly blogging again. You can also, probably, honestly, the easiest way to get a hold of me is, like Mike said, if you're in the Little Brothers with Slack, just at me or DM me. I'm actually pretty responsive on that stuff. And that is, like Mike said, patreon.com/TheBrothersWisp. Toss a couple of bones, join the army, become a little brother. Does that make us the big brothers? I guess, I don't know. I feel like when I'm in that chat, I am just another little brother, just another man in the foxhole trying to stay alive in there.
So in your little sign up thing there, you mentioned, you know, visit gregsoul.com.
Mm-hmm.
Once COVID's over, I want to go visit gregsoul.com.
You want to go to the data center where it actually lives?
I'm going to go down to college station. Like, all right, I want to visit. Show me gregsoul.com.
I could probably arrange a tour of the data center, even though I don't work there anymore. I could get you in there. We could walk around and look at some stuff. Maybe I could get them to give us a tour. So you got it. Deal. Well, part of my new job is I am a salesperson, believe it or not. I'm more on the technical side. I'm not like an account exec where I'm talking to folks all the time and badgering them. But that being said, I get to go to conferences, especially if I can tie it into my work. They actually pay me to go and do that stuff, which is bonkers. So hopefully I'll be able to do a lot of the Wispapalooza stuff, so long as I can parlay it into, hey, I'm talking to you guys about automation. That would be cool. The mums, I'll still, you know, I'll get paid to go to the mums. That'll be baller, you know, because I'm maintaining those relationships, those credentials, all that stuff. And I can talk about automation there as well, right? So, I don't know, a lot of opportunities as far as that stuff goes. So hopefully I'll be able to see a lot more people whenever this stuff calms down a little bit, which it inevitably will. So hopefully soon.
I think there's a spring WISPA show, and it's actually in Texas.
Yeehaw.
WISP America 2021, April 26th at the Gaylord Texan in Grapevine.
I'm not doing anything until I get vaccinated. So that's a hot topic.
My wife
topic.
Got vaccinated today.
Oh, baller. Well, I mean, she's working with all those old fools, so she needs to. But yeah, Post vaccination, 2 weeks where I'm at my full 95%, I'll feel a lot better about going and doing stuff for sure.
She actually worked today, and they knocked out, not physically, but they performed, I think they said 438 vaccinations, mostly old people, but some staff as well.
Gotcha. So you put them in the pen, you squeeze them, and then you pow, get them, and you push them out. The next one comes in. That's awesome. That's awesome, man. All right. Well, for all you guys listening, questions, comments, please keep them coming. You can email us, contactusandbrotherswisps.com, or you can find us on Facebook. Mikey's always posting stuff up there and very responsive with all that stuff. Please throw questions, comments. If you have any guests you want to see, please throw their names, especially if you can make a warm introduction. That always makes it easier. What you got, Mike?
And we're on Twitter, too. Don't forget.
Oh, there you go. There you go. If you're a Twitter fan. All right. Well, thank you, Mike. Thank you, all of you listeners. And we'll see you next time.
See you later.
All right. Time for the stops. So we hit stop. We come over here. And we hit.
Fun is the mission. I'm telling you, you don't know what you are missing. Ideas and some good comedy given. If you missed the show already, don't worry. You're forgiven.